You all know that this panel is one of my personal favorites every year because while there are 20,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., it is a relatively small community, and particularly in this sector, in the energy sector, we all know each other. We're all friends. And what I've tried to set up every year is just an opportunity for a bunch of us friends, come on up, to just have a conversation about how we see things and tee up some of the issues. Walking on stage now first is Marty Durbin. Marty is the Vice President, or Executive Vice President for Government Affairs for the American Petroleum Institute. Prior to API, Marty had been with the American Chemistry Council. Prior to that, he was on the legislative staff of Senator Alan Dixon from Illinois. So he knows a little bit about ethanol and agriculture policy from those days. Prior to that, he had been with Rick Boucher, a Democrat from Virginia, big coal-producing state. And so he's sort of seen this issue maybe from both sides of the equation. But while at API, he's always been a solid guy, great guy to work with. And, Marty, I appreciate you being here. Next to Marty on his left, we'll get to you.
Boy,
will we ever get to you. Shane Carr is the Vice President for Government Affairs at the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. He represents companies as diverse as General Motors, Mazda, BMW, Chrysler, Ford, Toyota. Have I missed anybody? Several, probably. He had been at the Department of Transportation, and prior to that, he had been on the legislative staff for Nebraska Representative Doug Beirider. So he also has some background of how important this industry is to everybody. Mike McAdams is to Shane's left. Mike is the president of the Advanced Biofuels Association, a relatively new organization. I noticed it was not on his bio, and I found that curious, but Mike's background is actually with British Petroleum. He cut his teeth in the government affairs office of BP. Now, Mike and I actually go back further than anybody on this panel because, what was it, 25 years ago? More than that.
It was
30 years ago. A long time ago. The two of us worked in the House Post Office as we both were paying our way through school. So Mike and I have been through many battles over the years. First, it was battling over mail delivery, I guess, and then when he was at BP, we'd do some battle then. Although Mike, to his credit, when I was years ago and he was at BP, he had me come in to speak to the entire leadership staff of BP because he recognized early on that that was part of the future of the industry and hopefully of his company. So Mike's been at the leading edge for quite some time. John Doggett on the far left is familiar to many of you, I'm sure. He's Vice President for Government Affairs for the National Corn Growers Association. Prior to that, he had been with the American Farm Bureau. And prior to that, he was a legislative assistant for Ron Marlinay, a good member from the great state of Montana, which is where John hails. He had a ranch in Montana. And he has done more, I think, to bring ethanol as an important part of the corn growers' focus than anybody I've ever known and people in that position. So, John, I appreciate you being here. Now, hi, Scott.
Good to see you, Bob.
Good to have you here.
Where are the exits?
Scott Faber is the new Vice President for Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group. Prior to that, however, no applause there. Prior to that, however, he was the Vice President for Government Affairs for the Grocer Manufacturers Association. In fact, Scott is the architect of the Food versus Fuel campaign.
That's the
I said we were all friends. Let me revise and extend. We all know each other.
That's right. In Washington, when somebody calls you their good friend,
that's not a good thing.
You're in trouble.
Before Scott would agree to come here, I promised him his personal safety. I just want to let you folks know I'm a lobbyist. You can't believe anything I say.
Can you show you the pictures of my children?
I do appreciate you being here. I want to mix it up a little bit this year, and And quite frankly, hopefully you'll spend a little time talking to some of these folks and you'll be informed. And so you can go back to the Environmental Working Group an even better lobbyist than you already are.
I've learned a lot from many of you already, so I appreciate the chance to be here.
Let's just sort of tee this off with a little, just sort of a general question about the political environment in Washington in which we're all working in, and just to give a sense as to how desperate lobbyists are that like to try to get things done. Maybe just walk through, what's your top legislative priority, and what do you think the chances of its success might be? And I'll start with you just because you're here.
Sure. Well, and again, thank you, Bob. It's really, I appreciate the opportunity to work with you and to meet many of your colleagues.
Let's see if you're thanking me at the end.
I think, you know, for the Environmental Working Group, our number one priority is to see the conservation title of the Farm Bill strengthened if we do have a Farm Bill in 2012. And I think there's a real opportunity for all of us to work together to make sure that farmers continue to have the incentives that they need to make sure that our rivers stay clean and that we provide clean air and abundant habitat for wildlife. And so I know that RFA and ethanol manufacturers have been working hard to improve the sustainability of your product, making sure that farmers have that suite of rewards in the Farm Bill, and making sure we continue the contract, what's called conservation compliance, when we renew this Farm Bill, is really important to us. So that'll be our primary focus. I think the real $64,000 question is whether there will be a Farm Bill.
Because I read your website and I see a completely different focus. One that's not quite so generous to the folks in this room. But if you're telling me that you're downplaying the elimination of the RFS and of the ethanol industry with your remarks today, sure, that's news. And Rachel, make sure you write that down.
I didn't expect to get out of this room without talking about the RFS.
We'll get to that. We don't need to get there now. But. Marty?
Well, from a legislative standpoint, just to be honest, I don't think we're going to see any kind of major energy legislation. So from an API standpoint, what we want to do is make sure that administration policy and policies around the country, frankly, are going to allow us to continue to see the benefits of the – I mean, it really is a game change out there. I know there's been a lot of comments thrown around this morning about hydraulic fracturing and the increased production, almost all on private lands, by the way. But those have all brought incredible benefits from energy security and job creation and economic growth. We'll have some more comments from the president this afternoon for him to set a few more campaign message points anyway out there on energy policy. But, you know, in all honesty, I think the public understands what the value and the benefit is there. So we're going to use this campaign year, much like you were saying you guys are, to keep those issues in front of both the voters and the candidates.
Good. Jane?
Well, after I was saying to Marty before this started, after a couple of years of not doing anything but kick the can down the road, the Congress, both the Senate and the House, decided in the exact same week that they would consider the highway bill, a small bill that folks may have heard about. And obviously that's a very significant piece of legislation to us on the vehicle safety side. If you had to handicap anything having a chance of getting over the goal line, it might be some version of that, but I don't think that the odds on that are very great either. But, you know, as you know, these things take up a lot of time and energy.
What's the automaker's interest in the highway bill?
A portion of the highway bill reauthorizes the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So from both a programmatic and vehicle safety standpoint, there are a number of provisions that affect how we design and build cars and also the programs that are in place to help reduce things like drunk driving, distracted driving, a lot of those kind of hot topics.
Okay. Mike?
Well, first, Bob, thanks for the invitation to be here. Congratulations to all of you in the room for having built 90,000 jobs in your industry and having brought almost a billion gallons of renewable fuels to the transportation pool. Unfortunately, I like to say we're the guys you hire to protect you from the people you elect, all of us up here. As Bob and I could tell you, over the 35, 40 years that we've been engaged in this, this has been in a most unusual Congress. And there are many people in America that believe that this Congress is broken, it's dysfunctional, a number of things. And so it's really it's a statement on how the current Congress works for all of us to be grousing up here as seasoned professionals for what our objectives are this year, because quite frankly, most of us would tell you that most of what we're concerned with, if it has a chance of moving at all, will occur after the national election for the president. It will be in a lame duck. So the previous panel, which spoke about a number of the tax provisions, and when you look in the biofuel sector, there's at least five different provisions that impacted this industry. Most of those folks are doing all of the groundwork now, or the foreshadowing work, to try to set that up for a lame duck, while all of us have been on a letter together now for over a year, trying to remind the Congress that the number one objective, the building block, the cornerstone for the entire biofuels industry, first, second, third, or fourth generation, is the renewable fuel standard. So our objective at ABFA this year is to preserve the renewable fuel standard with our colleagues across all the subsectors of the biofuels industry, and to lay the template that people that are willing to cast pieces aside think twice about it in the year 2013.
John?
Well,
are you all about the farm bill right now?
We're all about the farm bill, but I do want to thank the ethanol industry, because the ethanol industry sent a signal to farmers across the country, sent a signal to our input providers to ramp up their ability to use ever-evolving technology. You know, we're going to hear that 40% of the corn crop is going into ethanol. That's great, because that pie, that 40%, is part of a pie that's twice as big as it was 12 or 13 years ago, when ethanol was just a little piece of that pie. You know, we got a much bigger pie. And the growth is bigger than the amount that's going to the ethanol. And that's great, because that sent a signal to farmers that, you know, there's a possibility for profit here. And sent a signal to all the input providers and saying, you know, we really need to push technology, because the ethanol industry is going to do something that's good for this country and it's good for agriculture. And speaking of agriculture, yes, we are all about the farm bill. Hopefully we will get it done this year. I think we need to get it done this year. We need to have a farm bill that builds on the successes of the past, builds on the successes of the renewable fuel standard. Our growers want to go to a more market-based farm program that only gets involved in agriculture when agriculture cannot go ahead and manage the risk that Mother Earth and the foreign markets impose upon us. So I think we've got some good ideas coming forward, but I don't know if the dysfunctionality of this Congress is going to allow us to get there.
Yeah, you said that you need to have a farm bill this year. Do you think it's going to happen? And if it happens, do you think, as Mike says, it'll have to happen in a lame duck, because that's the only time anything can move?
I'm not going to go there. I think we're going to get done.
Right, Rachel, put your pen down. Off the record, what do you think?
Rachel is still here, isn't she? No, we are very encouraged with the signals we're hearing from the Senate, and we're very hopeful with the endeavors of the House that we can get a bill done before we get to Labor Day.
Marty, have you ever seen anything constructive get done in a lame duck session?
Well, yeah, there have been some things. Well, it depends on your definition of constructive.
Good point.
Superfund happened in a lame duck.
Scott, John had talked about the fact that the pie is indeed growing, and how much more corn is being grown now as opposed to 10 or 15 years ago. And I noticed on EWG's own website, you castigate the ethanol industry for chewing up millions of new acres and forest land, when in fact farmers are more productive. USDA data would suggest that farmland is actually decreasing. Our forest land is actually increasing. So now that you're at EWG, and I know that you're committed to having factual information, are you going to correct some of that stuff?
You know, Bob, I'm sure that I know you'll have your set of facts, and I'll have mine, and we'll have this debate for today and probably for some time. I'm a little bit younger than you, so I might...
Each have our own opinion, Scott, but I mean, there are facts there. The fact of the matter is that there's less farmland being used today than ever before.
Well, let me say a couple things, unless you want to sit down and let me moderate.
Okay.
So First of all, let me just say congratulations, because this industry is an incredible American success story. To go from where we were in 1978 to now be the world's largest producer of ethanol is an incredible success story. It's a reminder that government policy levers can help take an industry from infancy to maturity. As we look at what the president is proposing with his green energy agenda, and there are other successes to point to, as John alluded to, and we heard on previous panels, we've permanently raised the floor for corn prices. We've made it much more profitable to be in some kinds of farming, but that has come at some cost to others. And I think we need to recognize and be honest about those trade-offs. If you produce livestock, there are ways that we have helped livestock producers, but the bottom line is it's more expensive to produce livestock today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. There have been impacts on land use. There's more corn, more acres devoted to corn. There are fewer acres devoted to other crops. That creates new environmental challenges that we can all work together to address in the conservation title of the Farm Bill. I'm hoping I can challenge you, Bob, to be a part of that effort.
Well, John, are you going to be working on the conservation title on the Farm Bill?
Absolutely.
And are you and Scott going to agree on some of those provisions?
Not at all.
John's being facetious. I think all farmers, from whether it's corn growers, produce growers, livestock operators, have always been very strong supporters, not only of conservation programs, but also of conservation compliance, the agreement that in exchange for a robust safety net that farmers will do some basic things to reduce soil erosion and water pollution. So there are areas where we can work together. There are areas where we're going to disagree. I think the big question, and the one I know you really want to get to, is whether or not we need to really look again at the RFS for two reasons. One is you have been so successful. You're obviously exporting now 1.1 billion gallons in 2011, which is
1.19,
which is I think few people would have imagined even 5 years ago. Are there sufficient market forces in place to do a reevaluation of whether we need as aggressive a mandate for cornstarch ethanol? So I'm not proposing to eliminate it. I'm not proposing to phase it out. I'm proposing that we have the conversation, and I think it's a conversation people should be expecting to have in the next few years. So one question is it obsolete? I think the second question is it getting in the way of the more sustainable, advanced fuels? Because for better or worse, and we'll disagree about this for some time, we're going to be stuck in an E10 environment in the United States for a long time. And so how do we make sure that we bring advanced biofuels to market while recognizing realistically, pragmatically, that we're going to be living in an E10 environment for some time? So those are two of the questions, only posing questions. You want me to be provocative?
No, that's fine.
I think we should be discussing in the coming year.
Mike, he's suggesting that the existence of the RFS and the cornstarch ethanol industry today is actually inhibiting the growth of your sector. Do you see it the same way?
I think the panel before spoke to this very eloquently. This has been a commercial funding issue, not an RFS issue. Our association and the members in my association believe that we stand on the shoulders of the corn ethanol industry. They are our brothers. We believe one of the things that's, again, was alluded to by the earlier panel, that we've done a tremendous job at, as a biofuels industry, is to be a circular firing squad. While people got confused with what they were selling with their PowerPoints, as John had suggested, to try to raise money, they tried to pit one sector of the biofuels industry against another. I'm here to tell you, we absolutely are in the biggest challenge we've been in since 2005 when we passed EPAC. This goes to the fundamental of everybody's job in this room, and it goes to this election. The RFS is not a problem. We need to work together collectively as an industry. We need all the fuels. As the President said in the State of the Union, it's an all-of-the-above strategy. The President also, but don't forget, before we had the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, was the first President in a long time to try to open up leases in the Gulf of Mexico, to try to recognize that we needed to balance our overall portfolio. That, my message to my friends at the American Petroleum Institute is, for $6 million, it's probably a pretty good bet to try to have my guys to deliver a renewable crude oil for you all to run through your refineries than to waive it. So, again, Scott, I appreciate that you want to support the advanced biofuel sector. We've enjoyed working with you. We'll continue to work with you. But for this period, this moment in time, and for the people whose lives are impacted in this room, we got to stand together, we got to work together, and we got to move forward.
John, how important is maintaining the RFS to your membership?
I would say that if you took a poll of our members, and we may well do that at our Commodity Classic next week, I would say that they view the RFS as more important than the Farm Bill. And if what's interesting is I was in a meeting with all of the commodity organizations represented by growers and staff a month ago, and to have a cotton grower from one of the southern states stand up and say, you know, I raise cotton, I raise a little bit of sorghum, I raise some soybeans. But I'll tell you what, as a cotton grower, the RFS is as important to me as almost any other program or any other policy that the federal government has implemented. Because, again, you know, it's incentivized folks to make that investment in the technology, make that investment at the farm level, at the company level, you know, and at the research level. And so I think it's really important that we hold on to the RFS, and we've got, you know, absolutely, we've got to work together on these things. We've got to quit trying to figure out who's the winner and who's the loser, yep, because once we devolve into that kind of discussion, we all lose.
Marty, Mike had mentioned that one of his top legislative priorities is to defend tax against the RFS. Is he talking about you? Is the API going to be focused on dismantling the RFS in this Congress or the next?
I got to tell you, it's one of those things where I don't spend any time worrying about the RFS. You know, this is it's out there. We may have some issues with regard to implementation, and I know we're working with you guys on some of those issues. I mean, since we're all among friends, let me take a step back with regard to the need to work together here, you know, kind of across on all this stuff. In some ways, I feel like I've only been here since this morning. Like, I've already attended two different conferences. And the panel before, as Mike said, the very rational discussion talked about how, you know, not only the business end of it, but how they've got the, you know, partnerships with oil companies. Imagine that. By the way, I don't have horns or a tail, in case anybody know. But at the opening this morning, I mean, you're essentially telling everybody, man the barricades and painting my guys as an enemy to be vanquished. That's not what we are. Yeah, and you laid out a lot of facts this morning.
Well, if you could speak to Charlie Drevna, that would, we would really appreciate that.
I can't
because he does have horns and a tail.
I can't speak for Charlie, but yeah, obviously we work with the. But again, look to who your partners are. Yeah. Okay, and you got something to work on here. But yeah, then you get into the tax policy issues too. That, you know, you laid out a lot of facts, but kind of ignored the fact that the industry actually doesn't receive a single subsidy. You know, how you want to define them? We don't receive any subsidies. We also one of the few
so
industries.
So intangible drilling
is not a subsidy. We do get it, but yeah, it's no different than an R&D tax credit for any other industry. They're cost recovery mechanisms that every business out there is able to use. So there's no direct payments to the industry. Another fact.
Well, in the
is
same
that
way that the ethanol tax incentive was not a subsidy of our industry. It was actually going to the gasoline marketers and the refiners.
And you want to know how much time I spent? You want to know how much time I spent trying to get up there and save that? Zero. It wasn't an issue for us. Okay, so, but you know, this is an industry that every day puts $86 million into the federal treasury, created jobs all through the economic downturn, and we do have a game change coming with regard to natural gas and oil production. But that's not to say that's against biofuels. In fact, the other thing you will hear from us all the time, one of our talking points, is that in the next 15 years, with more production here in the U.S., using Canadian oil sands and growing domestic biofuel use, we can be North American independent for our liquid fuel needs.
Well, we're getting there now, largely as a consequence of increased ethanol production. We're
going
to get to the tax stuff in a minute, but staying on the RFS for just a few more moments. API and NPRA both have indeed petitioned EPA to waive the cellulosic portions of it. And what is the consequence of that? I mean, Mike will tell you what kind of an impact that has on his sector's ability to secure financing.
Yeah, I mean, we're just, frankly, we'll work with you on the RIN credit situation across the board.
Sure.
Because we don't want fraudulent producers to be rewarded with RIN credits. That's bad for all of us. Mm-hmm. So we're willing to work with you with EPA to make sure that we have a viable EMTS system that has real quantifiable gallons that meet the mark. Okay? But on the waiver request that you all put in, if they were to grant you the waiver, they've already, under the law, they've already lowered the number to start with. Over 90% they lowered the number, which is what the statute asked them to do relative to the available production they thought. And, oh, by the way, the number wasn't zero for, say, Elastic production last year. The number may have been zero under the EMTS system, but there was a whole bunch of cellulosic fuels being made in demonstration plants that weren't registered. So the number's not zeros, ladies and gentlemen. It's some other number, and you'll begin to see real numbers on the EMTS system this year. But to waive it after the EPA has already legally lowered the number, then games the system in both directions. And what Mr. Imbler was saying and Mr. Brady was saying was it sends a signal to the market that no single policy that was intended to bring the next wave of fuels into the marketplace is protected, because the RFS is the bottom line. So there would be nothing to say that you couldn't come back in 2012 after the proposed 8.5 million gallon number, that you just simply would never buy a gallon over the range of this full year, and you would ask to waive it at the end of next year. That sends an absolutely horrifying, chilling message to all of our potential producers.
Well, then we certainly should talk about how to make that work. But as the previous panel also said, it looks horrible every year when you say, okay, we got a mandate here, we're going to lower it by 90%, but we still don't even have that production. So we're on the hook for buying it and going to be penalized for not using it, but it doesn't exist. Not up to the level we need. So there's plenty of discussion to be had. We should work together.
Happy to do that.
Well, we do need to find the balance between assuring that there's still an incentive out there to encourage investment in this sector without penalizing the marketplace in a way that's counterproductive. But that's a dialogue we should be having together, as opposed to going to EPA and saying, you know, blow it up, it doesn't work. And I think we'd all be willing to work with you on that.
And then Rachel writes about it every day, and so we, you know. Mike, good job.
Let me stay on you for just a second, because moving off the RFS stuff, Marty is suggesting that, you know, the oil industry is not the beneficiary of all these tax incentives, although Lord
I didn't
knows.
Say that. I said we don't receive subsidies. We're able to use the same kind of cost recovery provisions that anybody, any other businesses out there is able to use. We do not receive subsidies or direct payments from the government.
It's a fairly profitable industry that continues to get tax incentives.
And thank God it is for your 401k and all the other retirees out there and for the jobs that are created for this economy.
All right, so I'm going to take an example. An unbalanced tax code that does provide incentives for the extraction of your raw material and no incentives for the extraction of renewable resources does create issues for financing.
So there are no incentives for corn production or any other?
Let's give a real-world example. I actually, unusual, I drilled two wells myself. I drilled one in Louisiana where I lost my shirt, and I drilled one in Greene County, Mississippi, where I did fairly well. And the great thing about the well in Greene County, Mississippi, is there's this thing called intangible drilling cost. And so the well was $1 million, and all of the investors that went into the well with me, they get a 35% upfront deduction. So even if the well doesn't hit, I could tell all my investors, oh, by the way, you're not going to lose all your money. You'll just lose 66% of it, but we're going to go to Las Vegas and you're going to be wealthy. That's how I sold the well. Now, so that's in the law. We don't have anything similar to that for biofuels. So, for instance, so the way the tax code's laid out, it gives different incentives to different folks. So for the solar and wind industry, there's a provision called 1603, okay, an investment tax credit, which essentially was the equivalent of the intangible drilling cost, because you could go to the bank if you built a windmill or a solar facility and you get 35% back up front, which was a collateral event where the bankers would actually fund it. We, for some reason in 2009, as the biofuels industry, were not included. So if I were to ask Wes, which would you rather have, Wes? Would you rather have an investment tax credit as a smaller company versus, say, Mike Parr from DuPont, who's a big company? Do you just want the production tax credit, or would you like an investment tax credit? You'd get two separate answers. But the real problem is we got nothing right now except for the production tax credit, and it runs out at the end of the year before we've even built the plants, and we're getting scored, and we're in a struggle in an environment where they're going to try to lower the overall rate and wipe out all the credits. So that's not technology neutral, that's not energy neutral, and that's not good for our country. We need to have a more even, performance-based code.
Scott, EWG was very vocal about wanting to eliminate the ethanol tax incentive. Has EWG taken a position on the imbalanced tax code, as at least as some of us on this stage see it? Because I haven't seen much about, issues.
One of the real benefits of coming to this conference was learning that RFA and I guess the advanced biofuels are looking at how to level this playing field. And I think that's something that we could all work together on. I think the real challenge, and it gets back to where you started, is what will Congress actually do in this year and whether we'll have some sort of a package of tax extenders or tax bill of some kind. And I think in order to make the case that you should get a subsidy credit, we all now know Marty's the best lobbyist on the panel.
Cost recovery.
Yeah. Cost recovery. I think that depends not only on whether you're producing a domestic source of energy, but it also depends on how big a coalition you can build and what other public goods you're providing. These subsidies, sorry, Marty, are going to be scrutinized in a way that they never have before because of the rightly so, because of the widespread concern around the country that we're running a $1 trillion deficit. So I think we all have an interest in coming together with a suite of tax policies that get advanced biofuels to the marketplace as quickly as possible. And we may have that, we may share that goal for different reasons, but I think we all have the same goal. And we all have an interest in working together to do that, because unless you have a coalition that spans the entire political spectrum, then you're not going to really stand much chance of making progress.
I think we'd all probably stipulate to the fact that not much is going to get done this year. But I think this debate about tax reform is going to continue. And, you know, Marty's certainly been up on the Hill a lot lately trying to beat back the efforts, repeated efforts, to use the oil and gas incentives that they don't benefit from as pay-fors for other programs, and that's certainly going to continue. You've certainly been very successful thus far in beating back those efforts, but I think Scott's right that that's just going to continue, and I think at some point the Congress is going to have a more meaningful and comprehensive dialogue about how do we have an energy tax plan that makes sense.
Well, and I think the VTEC is kind of a cautionary tale for many of these other credits. You know, at some point they just don't withstand scrutiny given the fiscal environment we're in, and it makes sense, and I think, you know, looking backward, it might have made more sense to say, okay, well, what are a suite of tax policies that help get advanced biofuels, cellulosic biofuels that are sustainable to the marketplace and build a coalition in support of that? We've lost that opportunity. Maybe we have a new opportunity to do something different.
Shane, I apologize. You've sort of been...
I've been happily in your blind spot.
One of the things, at least as it relates to this industry, that's always very important is how do we grow the E85 market, and how do we make sure that there's a larger demand out there so that we don't get stuck in the E10 world that Scott would like to keep us in. The auto manufacturers the U.S. auto manufacturers had made a commitment that 50% of the vehicles that they produce in 2012 would be FFVs. Are they going to meet those targets?
Well, everyone always forgets the entire sentence, which I periodically kind of go back and read the rest of. And I think at the time that those CEOs, I think only of which Al Mulally is still around, made that commitment, they also said, you know, provided that infrastructure and the demand were there for those numbers to make sense. I don't... As the association guy, I am not privy to the product plans of my members. There's antitrust problems with that. But, clearly, almost all of my members are producing at least some FFV models. As you mentioned, the three Detroit companies are producing a significant number of FFV models. We sold, I guess I haven't looked at 2011 numbers yet, but the expectation is probably a little over 1 million of the vehicles that were sold last year were FFEs. And my expectation is that number will continue to... It's grown slightly every year. My expectation is it will continue to grow.
Our own analysis actually suggests that they will meet those targets, which I think is terrific. The challenge has always been, how do we encourage some of the foreign manufacturers to see the priority of this flex fuel technology in the same way, and they've not done it. So we've been working with the Open Fuel Standard Coalition to try to provide some incentives. What's your view on the OFS coalition legislation
The Open Fuel Standard doesn't provide any incentives. It's just a mandate bill, and obviously, you know, we oppose technology mandates in general. My members do place different bets on different and competing technologies. Most of the companies actually have several different technologies in their portfolio. We don't think mandates are a good idea. We don't think government picking winners and losers is a good idea. We kind of sit in the middle of the broader ethanol debate in the sense that, you know, we are making FFVs, so clearly we consider ethanol, first and second generation, to be an important part of the nation's energy mix going forward, but we are not supportive of mandates. And I guess just incidentally...
So you guys don't support the electric vehicle mandate?
There's not an electric vehicle.
I mean the electric vehicle push. Because you're technology neutral. What's your experience?
There's no electric vehicle mandate, right? There is a tax incentive that the president has proposed making even larger, which I think we all know is DOA in this Congress. But we have supported and continue to support various incentives, including the FFV incentive that had been built into the fuel economy program and actually will be in place until 2020. But we have never supported mandating a particular technology because, you know, at the end of the day, consumers are going to sort out what they want and what works best for them.
Shane, the thing about the Open Fuel Standard is that it does not actually mandate a specific technology. It does leave it up to the autos to produce either an electric vehicle, a natural gas vehicle, a flex fueled vehicle, or anything else that you want, electric, I mean, whatever. Mm. And all it's saying is enough with the all-gas lead vehicles. That seems to me to be the most flexible mandate you could ever possibly have.
At least he's saying mandate. At least he's acknowledging it's a mandate. I appreciate that, Bob. Alternative fuel industry that is supporting the Open Fuel Standard is the ethanol industry. And the reason why is obvious. It is by far the cheapest way for manufacturers to comply with a mandate for some kind of alternative fuel technology. And so, you know, I think it's pretty well understood inside the Beltway that it's basically a stalking horse for an FFE mandate.
I can't believe the secret got out. There's lots of things flying around D.C. right now. Marty, the Keystone Pipeline, you think it happens or not?
Well, eventually, but whether or not you have that pipeline itself, you know, the Canadian oil sands are going to be developed. We have been bringing oil sands into the U.S. for decades. We will continue to do so. Whether or not the Keystone is built this year, that's a commercial decision that TransCanada is going to have to make. Personally, we hope that that we do have an opportunity to have either Congress or the President say, "Yep, it is in the national interest. Let's go ahead and get this started." It's both the job creation and the energy security that we're going to need as a nation. The government estimates are that, you know, by 2035, say, like right now, I think about 62% of our fuel need comes from oil and natural gas. Even with aggressive improvements and enhancements in renewables and alternatives and biofuels, by 2035, the estimate will still need 55% of our fuel from oil and natural gas. So it's not a question of will we be using it, it's where do we want to get it. And that's where we focus on. We should get it from here, and we've got a strong ally in Canada already. The pipeline, there's a lot of stalking horse issues on the pipeline itself. You know, tens of thousands of miles of pipeline. This would be the, you know, state-of-the-art, safest pipeline ever built. So I do think that there's a lot of politics, obviously, that are hung up on this, and eventually it does get built.
Yeah. John, you're in, you're out. I'm not sure you're going to be able to stick around for the food versus fuel debate that we actually have teed up.
Are we still debating that?
I think we're going to have it right now.
Why are we still debating that?
We didn't already have that.
But
that's what they put
really,
us
the architect.
Who's crazy enough to continue to bring that thing up? I mean, it's been disproven over and over and over again.
With the architect,
I think it's been decided.
The food versus fuel misnomer. What would you like to say to Scott, just to, so he can walk out of here truly better educated about this issue?
I don't think I'm the one that needs the education on this issue. So, Scott, we're raising a lot of corn. The market works. And we're not destroying Mother Earth to do it. I guarantee it.
I think that the challenge is not whether or not corn prices have been increased. I mean, Bob, you said as much in your presentation, which was terrific, that one of the success stories that the ethanol industry should really be congratulating itself for is we've raised the price of corn. We've created a new floor, essentially, for the price of corn. And that, of course, has had an impact primarily on livestock operators, because most of, you know, food processors use a relatively small amount of corn. Most of the corn went to feed. Now about half goes to feed, half goes to fuel, other than the parts
half,
that aren't exported.
Half.
Or 40, 48. We can do the numbers later.
Are you adding back in the DDGs?
I'll let you do that math. There's no question that we've raised the floor for the price of corn, and that's had an impact. I think, you know, the real challenge for everyone in this panel, and I think Keystone is sort of emblematic of that, is that people are hungry to see the really promising advanced fuels that we've heard about on the earlier panel get to the marketplace as soon as possible, whether they're alcohols or hydrocarbons. And I think it's fair to ask whether the policy framework that's in place is really the right framework to get those fuels to the marketplace sooner. It's also fair to ask, are we going to repeat the mistakes that we saw with the solar and wind industries, where we incubated some great technologies here in the U.S. only to see those technologies go overseas and really be developed elsewhere. So I think those are sort of the questions. I'm happy to reprise food versus fuel. I guess we can do that tomorrow. But I think if there's one take home that I've heard this morning, and I think we've heard from this panel, is we need to relook at tax policies. We'll be having asking questions about RFS. Just to kind of make sure that we've got the right suite of policy levers in place to get these advanced fuels not only to market, but to market here in a way that ultimately creates jobs in the U.S.
One of the lessons from what happened with the wind and the solar industries, however, is that the reason those technologies ultimately were exported is because incentives and programs in this country lapsed.
Yeah.
It wasn't a consistent federal program.
That's right.
This goes back to, and so for those of you who are Tea Party people in the room, I'm just going to take it straight up. We would not have airplanes in the United States today if it was not for the role of the U.S. government in World War I actually helping build the airplane industry. The post office was very helpful. There are examples after examples in this country of the partnership between the federal government and innovative technology industries, the computer, okay? Putting a man on the moon. For us to have this national conversation now, driven by a small number of people, that government involvement in moving forward innovative technology industries is an anathema because we have a federal deficit, goes right in the direction of what the futurist was talking about this morning, gifting this technology to China, gifting this technology to Brazil. So there is no question that any of us on this stage would agree we do not have policy across the energy sector perfect today. That would be an outrageous statement. Marty wouldn't say it for the oil industry. The natural gas guys wouldn't say it because they'd like to be part of the RFS now. They just want to rename it the alternative fuel standard. But we've got to have this national discussion that figures out a way, in a neutral policy way, to continue to move forward this innovative technology. Otherwise, it's going to be somewhere else, and we're going to be buying renewable fuels from overseas.
And I think that one of the lessons from wind, solar, some of the other policy targets that have their kind of sunny days and rainy days is you need a durable political consensus that will last for more than a year or two.
Yep.
And, you know, so the healthcare is not always a good example to bring up. I was a big supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but it wasn't a bipartisan consensus that ultimately is durable in the sense that it will survive sort of the attacks that are coming. We see that in the news right now. So how do you build a durable, long-lasting political consensus? I would argue you don't have that now. I would argue there are people like me, there are others, NPRA, I won't go through the whole list, who think that the suite of mandates and subsidies that are in place now aren't the right mix, and that we need to work harder at finding a durable political consensus on what these investments ought to look like.
But ultimately, are you committed to, or do you see the value of continuing to grow and evolve the biofuels industry so that you are developing more low-carbon alternatives, so that you're building upon the success, as you acknowledge the U.S. ethanol industry is, and that's going to require some consistent federal policy.
Yeah.
So ripping the legs out of policies that are today are working cost-effectively doesn't seem to me to be the right approach.
Well, I think we should have that. Here's my card. You know where to find me.
The new one.
The new one? Just got it this week. But I think, absolutely. Yeah. There's all of these fuels will have a place in our fuel mix. I think it's a question of how do we get these more sustainable advanced biofuels to the marketplace quickly, and do we have the right suite of policy tools in place?
Speaking of policies that the environmental community has been pursuing over a while, what's happened to climate change? A couple of years ago at this conference, that's all we wanted to talk about.
Climate's still changing, Bob.
And what's happening with it?
Well,
that's
another good example where you need to build a bipartisan, durable consensus around what it is that government should do to help reduce our emissions, to help create more innovation in our energy sector and our fuel sector. There are still people laboring in the vineyard, and I think many of us are still optimistic that the U.S. will show leadership and help bring all of the nations of the world together around an agreement.
Well, one of the reasons climate change isn't happening, or climate change legislation is going nowhere right now, is that the gentleman to your left has been successful in recasting that debate. And, I think you got to take some credit for that.
Look, as Scott said, I think what you don't have is any kind of durable political consensus around this issue. I think it was, personally, well, I'd love to see some action in this area. I think the industry would like to see some action in this area.
Really? On climate
change? You simply can't do this in comprehensive legislation these days anymore. It just doesn't, the mechanisms don't exist in our government the way it is now. I think it's going to take several more elections before we ever get back to something that we've all seen before and worked with before, where you could actually get people to work across the aisle and build that kind of consensus. Climate change is going to have to be addressed in more bite-sized pieces along the way with regard to energy policy and others as well. So it's not this either. I mean, if you want to know what happened to climate policy as far as some of the activists, well, go check out who's opposing the Keystone XL pipeline and now messing around.
So they just moved on to something else.
Absolutely.
Shane, wouldn't carbon legislation help you folks in some fashion to address CAFE standards in a slightly different way?
Well, I thanks for acknowledging my members' commitment to increasing fuel economy to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. I think the climate debate, to the extent that it lives on, has been recast largely as an energy security debate, though the terrain has certainly shifted. Certainly not the position of my association, but having seen how things have gone with RIN credits and EPA over the past year, one is kind of glad that they're not running a market that covers the entire economy.
That's quotable. John, agriculture, some would suggest that there may be opportunities for agriculture with carbon legislation that has gone away. But others, I think most of your members are probably quite skeptical, as Shane just suggested, that EPA could run a carbon program in a way that your members would not be hurt.
Well, I think you could write the rules to the way where agriculture could benefit, and you could write the rules to the point where agriculture would be devastated. And the answer is somewhere in between, and I'd much rather see it over here. I think that the conversation we had the last time we discussed this never really got to the point where we were going to have a discussion where there were winners. There was a lot of discussion about who the losers were going to be. And we were working very hard to make sure we weren't among the losers. I think everybody's talked that way, that we've got to find a way to deal with this issue in a fashion that people are willing to accept what the outcome is rather than running away from it.
And our failure to really to put a price on carbon, to do something in this space, is really a lost opportunity to create new markets for farmers, to create new markets for people who produce fuel. You know, other countries are going to leapfrog us because they'll incubate the new fuels, the new technologies, the new practices that ultimately serve the carbon markets that are going to either in place now or will be in place. So it's put aside, you know, those of you who are the climate skeptics, the science for a minute. This is really just a question of, do we want to be taking advantage of the marketplace that will inevitably grow as a result of carbon restrictions that are popping up around the globe?
I think the marketplace, the growers that we've talked to about this, their concern is that you can't on one hand sell credits that are worth a lot of money and then buy inputs that have to buy those credits and assume that those credits that those industries are buying are cheap ones. You know, I mean, the credit is worth what the credit is, and so we've got to figure out a way to resolve that imbalance, particularly when it comes to an industry that uses a lot of inputs.
I'm being told to wrap it up, but it would be moderator malpractice of me if I didn't at least throw out for these tremendous political prognosticators an opportunity to opine on the election. So I'm just going to ask every one of you, who do you think is the Republican nominee, and who do you think wins in November, and what happens with the Congress? John, go ahead.
Romney will be the Republican nominee. The president will be reelected. The Republicans will lose seats in the House, and it'll be a dead even heat in the Senate.
Mike?
I think he's got it right. I think the sad part is we're going to come back with the Senate, and if the Senate applies the same set of rules, we have the same issues with getting to 60 votes, which makes it very difficult to legislate. But I would say Mr. Obama is in pretty good shape, given what I've watched on the debates, and probably Mr. Romney squeaks it out, unless they pick somebody at the convention.
Shane?
I think the watchword for this year is volatility, and so since it's still February, I think it's going to be an incredibly volatile year, and I can't even really hazard a guess at this point.
Bob asks this question every
directly.
Year, and nobody remembers what the answers were. You're safe. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. Unless Rachel writes it down.
I've never won.
That's how you get the gray hair.
Marty, that's a pretty political. Don't cop out. Yeah. We're going to let Shane cop out.
Yeah. I actually think John has it right. I think the long primary process of the Republicans is not helping them. And I think that absent other externalities that we may have come along here, you know, the outcome is right. And I think Mike's also right. No matter what the changes are, and if the Democrats keep the Senate, which 8 weeks ago I would have said no, and now I say,
maybe.
Right. I think they could either hold it or yeah. It doesn't change the dynamic that you're talking about. You still can't build the consensus. You still got a 60-vote margin. It's not going to suddenly make things easy to get.
And the worst part is that the president probably is going to need to run a $1 billion campaign based on the investments that we've seen in the Republican primary. And so imagine $2 billion worth of advertising this fall, and I think people will hate this group of lobbyists even more than they do now. It's just bad for the country to see that much of that kind of advertising, and I think it undermines people's.
One other thing just to leave this crowd with, and that is that after the election, I don't think there's a single one of us that doesn't think there's going to be a crack in the dam and that there's going to be some movement. We've had it frozen for 18 months. There's too much pent-up demand, so you're going
to
see some legislative activity after the election.
Well, Scott, what you really want, you want all that money, though, to not be used on political advertising. You want to run another, you know, campaign in Washington, D.C. against ethanol, but it's not going to happen. I'll be real curious to see if at lunchtime with Karl Rove and Robert Gibbs, if they've got the same sort of thought process going with the elections as these political prognosticators. But we do have to wrap it up. Lunch is being served. We will have a tremendous presentation with Gibbs and Rove, so I encourage you to attend that. And I want to thank my friends for being here and engaging in a lively discussion.